Human beings are a funny creature, and we like to compare and contrast a lot of things. So Rolling Stone came out with this list of the 250 greatest guitar players of all time. Look, there are good guitar players. I'm a pretty good guitar player, but there are good guitar players everywhere. Then there's great guitar players, and you could find them in any town with a tattoo parlor, right? There's going to be people better than you everywhere. And then there are guitar gods, a lot of them on this list. And then there are guitar gods who give birth, not literally, but almost quite literally, to other guitar gods. And one of those is with us now, a guitar god who gives birth to other guitar gods, Mr. Joe Satriani. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, that's great. Thank you. What a fantastic introduction. Thank you.
It's a bit of a visual, but it's incredibly true. I mean, you are the guy. You are the wizard that many of us look up to as the GOAT of guitar players. How do you feel about this list and this incessant need for people out there to compare and contrast and list their betters and who's best? And do you people of your caliber even pay attention to this kind of noise, or is it, what is it?
I think there's definitely two ways to think about it. Maybe there's three. Yeah. So we'll start from the back. The third way to look at it is that it's just fun. You know, that in other words, people are talking about guitar players, thank God, right? So for us guitar players, we have to look at that and go like, okay, great. At least we're in the conversation, which is great, because sometimes we're not. And we're trying to get people to listen to our music. And so that's important. The other side of it is the fact that we don't really think that way. I think the serious artists know that there's no way to really put artistic creation together with success in the marketplace and all the way on the other side to technical ability. It just really doesn't make any sense. The fastest player is not the most successful player necessarily, but they can be for a moment. But you can't use those elements to judge, I think. That can be confusing for someone who's starting out, because they want to know, what should I do? How should I practice? You know, should I concentrate on my haircut? Should I get a good lawyer? I think that was Frank Zappa's advice, right? Get a good haircut and a good lawyer. Or should I just express myself on my instrument and not pay attention to anybody? And if I'm lucky, I'll get successful in spite of, you know, me not paying attention to the trends or whatever. On that level, that number two is a big one. It's a philosophical one that players that really do deliver new creative messages through their guitar to the audience, they have to, it's going to be an internal struggle, but that's okay. It's just, I think that's going to hit an architect and a scientist in the same way. They have to figure those things out for themselves. The other thing is, I think the first one, which is the one that hits the average person who might see it come by on their social media feed, somebody's that they never even listened to is in the top 100, and someone they listen to their whole life is somehow 199 or 249. And they go like, you know, where are these Rolling Stone editors at? You know, it's like, how could they come up with that? And so I get that all the time. You know, I won't pay attention to it, but my inbox gets flooded with people saying, you know, this is a travesty. This is, can you believe it? You need to call somebody. This person's ahead of that person, you know. But it's a joke. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. I think it's just Rolling Stone having some fun, and they're pretty good at it. So I'm not going to get in their way.
There's one thing I think a lot of us could agree on that they got right on the list is that Jimi Hendrix is at the top.
Yeah.
And I know that he has a special place in your heart starting off the very beginning. You actually quit in the middle of football practice when you hear Jimi Hendrix passed away. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
You're like 14, 15 years old. Can you take us back to that moment at all?
Yeah, it's funny. It rolls back, you know, like I'm 9 going on 10. I become a drummer. I'm taking lessons at home. A professional teacher came to my house once a week and teach me down in the basement. I tried really hard for about 3 years and started to phase out from being a drummer because I thought, I don't think I can get these four limbs to truly behave like Mitch Mitchell or, you know, other drummers that I was listening to at the time. And I think I started to really be influenced by the playlists of my older siblings, my older sisters, my older brother. So I just had this musical catalog in my head that was a little bit ahead of my years at the time. And by the time I was turning 14, I really had gotten into Hendrix. I just thought he was the greatest thing. Every time I heard his music, it stopped me in my tracks. I didn't know what he was doing. I wasn't a guitar player. I just loved it. And it really, I think, changed my DNA that first moment I heard his music coming through the radio. So there I am, though. I'm just a young kid and I'm on the football team. I've always loved being in sports. So it was a normal thing to be on the football team. And I was all suited up, standing right outside the gym, ready to walk out onto the field at Carr Place Public High School. And a teammate just came up and said, "Hey, that guy you like, Hendrix, I just heard he died." And then that, you know, changed my life right there. That was something that devastated me. So I just turned around and I walked into the coach's office. Coach's name was Mr. Redden, ex-Marine, hardcore guy. And there must have been something on my face, the look of my face or something, because I just said, "Look, Hendrix died. I'm quitting the football team." And he just said, "Okay, go do what you want," you know. And I was expecting a big argument and a threat. I think it was, I think there was a little extra thing going on there, which was I wasn't a very good football player, obviously, because I wasn't big enough. And you know, once you turn 14, the big guys start to grow big, you know, in your class. And so people start to separate. So that may have had something to do with it. He figured, I don't really need that kid, you know, that long haired kid who wants to play, you know, rock and roll. So, yeah, I went home that night and at the dinner table, I stood up and said, "I have an announcement. You know, I'm going to become a guitar player because Jimi Hendrix died." And it was a lot of yelling and screaming and confusion. But when everything settled, I got the go ahead. And it was my task then to not give up like I had given up on the drums, that if I was going to get cooperation from my parents and siblings, that I was going to have to prove that I was going to really do it this time.
Do you happen to remember your first guitar? Did you have a good first guitar at that point?
Well, it's right around that same time, my sister Marion had, you know, been playing folk guitar for years. She wrote folk songs and it was a nylon acoustic and she would play it at high school. And so she had let me borrow the guitar with a little chord sheet that had about 17 chords on it. And she was showing me where I could put my fingers. But that day, that evening, when I said that I wanted to change my life and become an electric guitar player, my sister Carol said that she would donate her first paycheck from being an art teacher at the Westbury High School to getting me a guitar. And I had seen one down at the local mall, and it was a Hagstrom 3. It kind of looked like a white Stratocaster, but in my, you know, kid's brain, I didn't really know the difference. I didn't know what to look for in an electric guitar. I just saw the horns. It was kind of like those Hagstroms, they kind of look like a cross between a Stratocaster and an SG. And it just looked really cool. And it was about $100 or $120, something like that, which was a lot of money for us. So that was a commitment and I had to work it off. I had to show everyone I was going to go the distance with it.
How long did it take for you to realize that you're probably quite a bit more advanced than the other kids that might have been playing at your age?
I have never felt that way.
Really?
No, I've never felt that way. But I learned really early on to enjoy what I was and my position compared to other talented people. Because you have to imagine, I start out, I'm the only one in the family who's decided to try to become a musician. Everyone had far more good sense to look for a real job. And so I'm playing and I'm thinking like, how come I don't sound like Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and, you know, Pete Townsend and Keith Richards, all these great guitar players. I'm listening to it, but I can't figure out their finger positions. I can't find a teacher who's cool enough, who understands rock music. And, you know, there's no internet, no DVDs, video cassettes, there's none of that. You're kind of like stuck with searching your community, you know, your people close by to show you what to do. And I really had nobody. So it seemed to me like I was struggling. And at the same time, I was getting a really fantastic education in music theory from a guy named Bill Westcott, who was a young teacher right out of Juilliard, and he was teaching music at Carr Place High School. And I really got along with this guy, and he somehow, you know, he would look at me, you have to imagine, I had hair down past my shoulders, wearing motorcycle boots, black jeans, black t-shirt, denim jacket. I listened to Black Sabbath and Zeppelin and Hendrix. And he somehow decided that he would still spend a few extra moments with me to teach me music theory any way that he could. So when I got home and I would pick up the guitar, I started to see music on the instrument. And this really was my ticket. And this was part of a lesson that he gave me once when he said, you know, it may turn out when you're 18 or 19 that you're not as good as a guitar player as you thought you were going to be. And you're going to reach a physical limit, but your mind, your musical mind, can keep going forward until you're 80 years old. He said, so that's what you should be concentrating on. Don't give up the practicing and learning songs and all that kind of stuff, but this is where all the really cool stuff is going to happen. And I took that to heart, and I started to realize that whatever sort of physical roadblocks that I was feeling, like if I was slower, I couldn't stretch, or my fingers hurt, or I couldn't pick the way I saw other people picking the strings, that I would come up with a workaround using my brain. And then around that same time, I start to meet these young kids who want to take lessons from me because they've seen me play at the high school gym or at the park or some backyard party or something like that. One of them was little Steve Vai, and he was 12 years old when I met him. He went to the same high school, so we kind of knew all the same people, got in trouble in all the same places, liked the same music. But I knew after a couple of weeks that he was uniquely talented, and I thought, oh my God, this guy is going to go so far past me physically, you know, with his technique, as he just had it. And then as we kept moving forward the lessons, I realized that his brain also had that same hunger that mine did, that we really wanted to know the secrets of music, all of it, not just rock guitar. And I think this is where that special bond between us was forged. It's also where, as I said before, I learned that lesson really early, that I was not the guy in the group that could play the fastest, stretch his fingers the furthest, play the most complicated or any of that stuff. That was not me. And what really excited me was writing music that I don't think anyone else could write, and to push the boundaries of chord progressions and combining rhythms and melodies and these chord progressions into creating new music. And I love that. I love that more than sitting down practicing, you know, a particular run for 8 hours day after day until it was faster than the way my friend could play it. You know, I got no joy from that. So that was a turning point for me, I think.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is so much different than like traditional rock and roll where you have a singer, right? Because you are the singer. You're the voice with your notes and your hands. And it, can you talk about how different that is maybe than the traditional rock star, not lifestyle, but you know, how it's marketed and how it's received by the public? You're preaching to a very specific audience of guitar players around the world. Are those audiences like different from one another? Are they growing? What is that kind of world like compared to, I guess, maybe the rest of the music industry?
Yeah, I think, instrumental music has been around for centuries, and as we know, and but there's nothing that communicates more directly, I think, than the human voice. And so I'm not competing, I'm not fighting against, I'm not trying to change the world. And if I could sing really well, I would. But I've been in bands where the singers are like, you recognize that they were born that way, that they have a special gift. So it never enters my mind. I think that when I started listening to guitar players, mainly like really paying attention, which was early Beatles and Stones, a British Invasion music that my older siblings were listening to, that I would always gravitate towards the brooding, the moody, the instrumental part of the album for some reason. And when Hendrix came out, I remember listening to that first album, and Third Stone from the Sun made such a big impact on me. You know, all my friends wanted me to play Foxy Lady and Purple Haze. And I kept saying that we should be playing Third Stone from the Sun. That is like, that's music to me. And it was in those early days, it was cathartic just to sit and listen to it, you know, just to pay attention so closely to what he was doing. And so that connection to the guitar as an instrumental music generator was really important to me, that those early experiences, just sitting down and focusing on what was coming off of the albums, was really important. I love that part of it. And I started to notice that players all over the spectrum of music were displaying that talent. Like I heard my parents playing Wes Montgomery, and I thought that's perfect. That's beautiful. That's exactly what I would do if I was a jazz guitar player. That's just like the epitome of perfection on jazz guitar. When I heard them playing Miles Davis records and I heard the way Miles played, I thought, this is perfect. This, you don't hear somebody reciting or regurgitating all of their practice routines in front of you to try to get a rise, to try to get validated, you know. It's just music. You know what I mean? It's like when you listen to Hendrix, you can't hear any exercises. You don't hear scales the way that you would lift them off of an instruction manual, you know, about how to play a scale or how to play guitar. This I thought was really high art. They were creating music on their instruments, but they weren't simply showing you what they've practiced. And that really struck a chord within me. And I started to notice that with other players. Like, so in my high school band, we'd go to play some Humble Pie, and I'd listen to Peter Frampton play a solo, and I'd think, what is that? It's like, what are all those extra notes? And why does it sound so beautiful and melodic? And it was because Peter is just who he is. That's the way he played. He didn't really try to copy anybody or display, again, practicing technique. So I started to figure out that there was a difference between people who played and tried to get their music out to you and people who played to try to get famous for their technical accomplishments. And I started to see that this was an important line. You had to draw a line in your daily routine. Like, am I going to concentrate on writing original music and playing in an original way? Or am I just going to try to get ahead, you know, with the physical attributes that I have? I think I've mentioned this before to one of your other questions, but, you know, musicians, they have to make decisions every day because it's really hard to find time to practice. It's really hard to allocate the minimal funds you might have to decide, am I going to buy strings or another guitar or a pedal, or, you know, should I just stick with what I got? And so these decisions sometimes are more simple in the real world, and other times they're really philosophical. Like, should I practice or should I work, figure out a way to tear open my heart and share my true feelings with my audience. That's I know that's a big one, but that's, I think, the real one.
And what about like getting in a rut, like a creative rut? Because this translates, I think, to all creatives when you're stuck, you know, playing those repetitive notes or the scales or that practice routine, and that's all you can get out. How do you break free? What's your personal, because I'm sure you probably, everybody, all creatives go through it, right? I'm assuming a lot here. Yeah. Assuming you get to that point, what do you do to break free of that kind of monotony or that repetitive trap?
Oh, well, let's say if you're just a guitar player and you don't have any other creative outlet, I would say just stop playing all the stuff that you're playing currently and put on some music that you never listen to. So if you're into country music and you never listen to heavy metal or something like that, go put on some heavy metal and just say, can I play that? Like, how is that guitar player actually doing that? How, like, if I had a sit in with Gojira, how could I accomplish that? And then, you know, spend a week on it. Maybe, you know, if you can, if you're not gigging and you don't have responsibilities like that, then try to figure that out. And I would say the opposite way. You can, you know, if you're a heavy metal guitar player, get some, you know, look up Roy Clark on YouTube and say, wow, look at that guy play. Yeah. Like, can I do that? Like, how does he do that? How do you get to that level of supreme musicianship, even though it's not your style, you know, that you're not going to listen to it, you know, during your daily routine? You, as a guitar player, it would really open up some new vistas for you to try to embrace a Roy Clark and a country guitar player looking at Gojira or whatever. So you can imagine, you just mix and match. I used to find that I'd go and, years ago, I bought a Rolling Stone songbook, and traditionally songbooks are goofy because they generally don't really get into the unique tunings that bands use, rock bands. You know, they just retune, they're a half step higher, half step lower, open tunings, whatever. And so they have to kind of, I don't want to use the phrase dumb it down, but they have to make it more accessible to everyone. So, you know, a song that was recorded in E shows up on E as E flat in the sheet music. But I just, one of these days, it went by me and I thought, you know, I love the Stones. I've been listening to them my whole life, but I purposely have avoided learning every single song because I don't want to copy them. And it would take too much time because their catalog is huge. But I'd get to a week and I'd say, no, this is what I'm going to do. I just finished a tour. Every day, I'm just going to open up that songbook and I'm going to pick a song that I don't hear very often from their catalog. And I'm just going to learn how to play it and see what happens when my fingers fall where Keith's fell when they recorded it. And you learn things like that from just playing outside of your normal routine. And then you can do it by yourself. You don't need a band. You don't need to get invited to somebody else's gig or session. It's something that you can do on your own. And that's an old-fashioned style way of doing it. Boy, if I had YouTube when I was a kid, I would have learned so much faster. So today, if I'm thinking about something that I always loved but never really sat down and figured out how to play, I can find it in 2 seconds and I can find 100 people doing it in slightly different ways. And I can look at it, which I think is really important. Cause when you see somebody play it, you learn so much just about.
Do you posture. Think that would have helped or hurt your progression?
I don't think there's any way to figure that out. There's no way to answer that question, really. It just is, you know?
Sure.
It just is. I was just thinking, somebody asked me the other day about, you know, simplicity, complexity, and I was reminded of this story in one of the chapters of that great book about Beethoven. It's a very complete book about his entire life, everything from when he was born to when he passed away. And this one set of chapters was dealing with the fact that he was, you know, desperate for money most of the time, and music publishing started to kick up because pianos were getting made for regular people that they would put in their parlors, you know. And he made a deal to write 60 pieces for money that he desperately needed. But he was instructed, please, just like some simple stuff, you know, so that people can put the sheet music up and they can play them, you know? And cause they're, you know, kids and parents and stuff like that, just having, you know, playing music in their home. It was a new thing. And so he did the right thing, which was he did dumb it down, you know, than his usual complexity, but we have this beautiful, you know, collection of Beethoven now that we don't think of in terms of, you know, complexity or non-complexity or good or bad or anything. We don't, the world has forgotten why he did it and isn't passing judgment. They're just saying, wow, when you hear Moonlight Sonata, you go, who cares if it's easy to play? That's beautiful, you know? So would YouTube have made a difference for me and Steve when we were kids growing up on Long Island, learning how to play guitar? I think it would have enhanced our playing. But I suppose the bigger question is, if there was YouTube, you know, back in 1970, what would have been on it? I mean, I remember that year. It was a crazy year. I can't imagine some of that stuff being available every second of the day, from every part of the world. I mean, the world's always been crazy, but I remember it being particularly crazy.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Let's fast forward, 30 years or so. I mean, it's quite a career to kind of gloss over, but maybe we can return and zero in on some of those points. But let's forward to the mid-90s, and you are in the full swing of your career. You decide to get Steve Vai and Eric Johnson together for this G3 thing. How did you get that started? Why? And how's it going now?
Well, it's an interesting period because I'd survived the popularity of surfing. You know, I went from obscurity to having a platinum album. And I went from trying to be a solo artist for about 3 weeks and I wound up in Mick Jagger's solo band. A lot happened. It might seem like it was overnight success, but actually it was decades of super hard work. And, but there I was after a couple of years of riding high and, you know, surfing was out and flying and the Extremist, all really successful records and tours were very successful. I'd come back from a really long tour in Europe and I went into the Bill Graham management offices and I said to the guys, look, everything's great and thank you. You know, everything's been going great. However, I said, I feel so isolated. I said, every time, you know, I'm in London, all my friends are in LA or New York or Sydney or Tokyo. And then when I finally get to Sydney or Tokyo or LA or New York, they're all in Paris or Frankfurt or something. I said, when do we all get to hang out? Because when I was a kid, I always imagined, you know, sitting, listening to albums and reading, you know, the rock and roll magazines, that musicians hung out with each other all the time, you know? Right. And because you'd see pictures of Hendrix with Clapton and Jeff Beck, and you hear all these stories and you think, well, that's what I want to do. I just want to hang out with my fellow guitar players and do all this collaborating. But in fact, in my world of guitar slingers, we were kept separate. And we, you know, you started to realize, like, even though at home, when you play guitar, you didn't feel this competition. You know, you would hear it from the press person that, well, you can't get the cover because that guy's getting the cover. And that person doesn't want to be on the show because he doesn't like you. And his manager says he should never be anywhere near you. And the promoters are saying, well, I'd rather see this guy in March and that guy in April and the other guy in July. Don't want them close to each other. And all I saw was barriers. You know, just like brick walls and fences. And my main complaint was, I want to hang out with my fellow guitar players. So what can we do? And I started to see a lot more festivals kick up, like Lollapalooza. And I said, I know it's a stretch, but what if we made our own festival of some kind where all of the guitar players would want to come and play with each other? It's obvious there are fans out there who want to see the guitar players. Why make them wait and never see us collaborate, you know, when they see other artists collaborating in different styles? So I didn't think it was that odd. You know, I mean, Al Di Meola, John McLaughlin, and Paco had done it acoustically. I saw the Three Tenors album going platinum. When I was growing up, my parents had lots of jazz records where the horn players would get together. They'd have three or four famous horn players putting together great live albums or studio albums. So I didn't think it was that unusual. But it did take about 3 or 4 hours of us sort of hashing out these ideas, like what's possible. We whittled it down to three because we realized that, you know, when you go out and you go to book the Beacon Theater, you're literally renting it, right? So you rent it for a night and they have rules. You know, you can come in at this time to load in. The union says you got to stop and do nothing during these periods. You have to take the stage here and you better be off the stage there. And by this time, you're out of here.
Wow.
those are the rules, right? So that's just the reality of touring for all musicians. And so we figured, well, how are we going to get all these guitar players? Like, we can't have 15. No one's going to show up on tour and play one song, right? So as we kept on going, well, what about five? What about four? When we got to three, we realized if it's three guys, then everyone gets to play anywhere from 45 minutes to 55 minutes, which is enough time for them to play songs from the new album, songs that their fans really want them to play that's from their extensive catalog, if they've got one. And that way they feel like they're doing the business they need to do, because they'd be touring with G3 in lieu of, you know, touring on their own. So we had to work out that kind of a detail. Then it literally took a year, because I knew who I wanted. I really wanted Steve and Eric to be the first two guys that I brought out. And it just really did take a long time to convince, not so much them, but I think their managers and record companies, that yes, these three gunslingers were going to stand right next to each other every night. And it was inevitable. Someone was going to play better than the other one at some point on, you know, night after night. But I kept telling them, like, forget about it. The audience doesn't care. They walk in the door. They know who their favorite is. You're not going to change their mind. That's not why they're there. They're there to enjoy all three of us, to love the one that's their favorite, and then to go, oh my God, they're actually playing together. They're playing that song that I've never heard them play on their albums, and they're doing it together. And they're improvising, and they're having fun, and they're getting us to join in, you know. And it worked. I mean, it was, the feeling I had was that me being in the audience, that's what I wanted to see. And I felt like I was being deprived of that experience. And that, together with the fact that I felt that my success was isolating me from my fellow musicians, those two factors really drove me to make sure that we would accomplish this concert series.
Can you talk about a little bit about the difference between your playing styles between the three of you? Because, I mean, you and Steve kind of have a little bit of a, you know, similar kind of tone almost, not the same playing style at all. But then Eric Johnson's kind of the softer kind of rolled back almost country sound into the mix. Yeah. Can you expand on and then the way the three of you kind of bounce off each other and how that dynamic works?
Well, first of all, they're unbelievably talented musicians. You know, what they hold in their hearts and in their minds and how they get it out on the guitar is just insanely amazing. I can look at the two of them and I can say, well, I know where Steve comes from, because I could walk to his house in 10 minutes, you know, growing up. And Eric grew up in an entirely different place and had different influences. And so as we grow up, you know, we like what we like and we gravitate towards that. And whether we're musicians or artists, it's going to be reflected in what we produce. So there's that's really different. I think what unites us as a trio is that we love the guitar. We love that it can sound so many different ways. We love listening to somebody play something that we never would have played or thought of. We like being surprised. We love improvising. We love playing with the element of sound as part of the artistic expression. In that way, I think because of our generation, we heard Hendrix use sound in a masterful way to convey feelings. And before then, it was more like notes, you know. but once the volume went up and distortion was involved, and people started playing with feedback, and there were pedals that did different things, the sound became part of the message, and that's our generation. You know, we grew up learning how to play as that was being practiced for the first time, let's say. Now, Steve and I, it's a whole other thing because I can't explain it, but all I know is that when we start to play on stage together, we're just sort of picking up where we left off. And it's almost as if we're just kids again, and we're just, you know, I've just said to him, look, let's just play in C, Dorian, play whatever you want. And, you know, we used to do that. And when he graduated so quickly from being a beginner into someone who could really improvise, and he was such a good student, that we could literally sit back to back, like weather permitting, in my backyard with our guitars, and we would just play. We would just improvise and just listen to the cascading notes. And we found a beauty in that. We found that there was a artistic communication between us in that exchange that we loved, and it enriched our personal musical journey, as well as just being plain old fun. You know, I have to say we're both shameless lovers of the rock and roll thing, you know.
Do you still have fun with that? Do you still rock out by yourself and just still get the goosebumps when you're flying in a blue dream, for like a better term?
Yeah. I do. I really do love it. And I think, you know, one of the things is kind of important. It came up in an interview just 2 days ago. It centered around Hendrix. And, you know, when I started to play guitar, I told you the story, the days following that decision, I learned and had to really come to grips with the story that had ultimately resulted in Jimi Hendrix dying. And so he was haunted and, you know, haunted by what he had created, the entertainer, Jimi Hendrix, the entertainer. He was trying to be taken seriously, and it was beginning to drive him crazy. The rock and roll antics, the show part, the entertainment part of it. And I remember thinking, well, I certainly don't want to die when I'm 27. So I need to avoid what all these people, and there were quite a few people dying at that time, you know, rock and roll stars were overdosing and whatnot. And I was just thinking like, well, you know, I need to, I'm not this person. First of all, I'm shy. I don't really know how to walk out on stage. It terrifies me. So I'm not that kind of a personality, you know?
Really?
And I thought, well, I'm going to keep it simple and keep it about the music as much as I can. So, you know, but then I have this buddy of mine, my best friend, who's just kind of like the opposite. Steve is like a natural to walk on stage and to do the full entertainment.
Yeah.
And this difference is really fun. I find it really a lot of fun.
An introvert and an extrovert.
When we were starting G3, and Steve said, what side of the stage should I be on? I said, what side of the stage? You're going in the middle. You know, it's like, I want you to be in the middle, man. You know, it's like, you're the ones going to do that. Cause I know Eric and I are going to be, you know, maybe looking down a bit more than we should. I don't know. I'm going off on a tangent here, but there's so much about that I could go on and on about the players that I've invited on G3. But I suppose I can crystallize it by saying, I really want to celebrate the differences. They've all been the best musicians ever, and they walk on stage with the best intentions, and they're all different, and we're all different from each other, and we just give each other space to show that and you know, lift the audience.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today, sir. It's the G3 Tour. It's going on, kicking off on January 23rd in Tucson, Arizona, and wrapping up on February 10th in Los Angeles, California. And it looks like you guys also have a cruise, a Monsters of Rock cruise in Miami. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I should mention, you know, that the G3 Tour is also being filmed, not for a concert film, but for a documentary. My son, Zizi, who turned 4 just as we started the G3 Tours. And that was the beginning of him spending his life with his parents on the road, going out on these tours. So he kind of grew up on these tour buses, hanging out with Steve Vai and Eric Johnson, Robert Fripp. He's a young filmmaker, and he wanted to sort of figure out how to tell the story about, you know, what is it like to grow up with a really strange father and alongside G3 and what, you know, and sort of parallel what the guitar means to each one of these people who have been part of G3. And so he's been around the world interviewing Brian May and Robert Fripp, and he'll be in New York.
Love to talk to him.
Steve Miller and John Petrucci and Al Di Meola. He's got Tom Morello, even Nigel Tufnell talking about the guitar. And it's going to come, the film is going to actually culminate with those last two shows in Los Angeles at the Orpheum Theater. It's an interesting thing that we've embarked on. Not only is it the, you know, the sort of getting together again, the original G3 lineup, the reunion tour, but having it documented by Zizi has been quite unique, and it's been revealing a lot more about how all of us feel, not only about the G3 tour, but just guitar, our lives with guitar, because we've been doing it for a long time, you know. And Zizi's been prying these things out of us, getting us to reveal our feelings as well as our secrets and impressions about guitar and music. And you mentioned the cruise. Yeah, I'm doing a Monsters cruise. It's my first cruise, never even been on a cruise ship. So bring some Dramamine for me.
Wow. Big thanks to Joe Satriani for stopping by Newsweek Radio. That was the opportunity of a lifetime in my book to talk to somebody like that. I hope I get the chance to do it again soon, because I've got like so many more questions now after all those other questions. I was floored, actually, here in this interview, that Joe is such an introvert, because I'm an introvert too, and I had no idea that he was such an introvert, and that Steve Vai is kind of his polar opposite. I'm going to be talking to Steve Vai here too in the very near future, a big thing I can't wait to show you. Also talking to Eric Johnson, that'll be next. We'll talk to Eric Johnson in the next interview that I do here on Newsweek Radio, and then coming up after that is a very special interview with Steve Vai. There are so many good guitar players I've been talking to recently. It's like there is no best, right? And that's one thing I'm learning here. There is no best. Once you reach this certain apex of God guitarism, then you just are. You just are. There is no compare or contrast when you're that damn good. And these guys are the best at what they do. And it's so awesome to be able to talk to them. I'm a huge geeked out fanboy, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. So stay tuned. More Newsweek Radio coming up with more big interviews with some of the world's best guitarists. And of course, top headlines from around the world from newsweek.com. Take care.